How have our perceptions of the West been influenced by writers, painters, and photographers?
I argue in this book that most of our Western wilderness imagery actually comes from the Northern Rockies. You don't find very much of it in the Southwest, really not very much of it in California except in Yosemite and the Sierras. The most famous wilderness visual imagery comes out of the Northern Rockies from people like Albert Bierstadt and Thomas Moran. So I think they gave us an image of this part of the world as a wilderness. They gave us an image of a West where the Indians are vanishing or have vanished, and the only way you can reconstruct Indian life is to look back in time 50 years before these painters are working. I think they, in some respects, sort of skew the history for us.
Welcome to The Right Question, a weekly program about writing and publishing in the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, and my guest today is historian Dan Flores. Flores holds the A.B. Hammond Chair in Western History at the University of Montana, Missoula. He is the author of 8 books and numerous articles published in magazines such as Texas Monthly, The Big Sky Journal, Southwest Art, and High Country News. This program is the first of 2 in which we'll be talking about Flores' new book, Visions of the Big Sky, Painting and Photographing the Northern Rocky Mountain West.
Sitting on the banks of Idaho's Salmon River one August a few years ago, sifting our toes through the white sand of our camps along the fabled River of No Return, I and some other river runners came up with a question that none of us could quite answer. But as the days in frothing green water and nights under the moon and Mars passed, the more I thought about our puzzlement, the more I came to think that we had been idly probing the heart of regional identity in the Northern Rocky Mountain West. The question was really a simple one. How has it happened and why that the past 200 years of history in the West has granted the states of California and New Mexico world-class legacies of photographers and painters while reserving major music traditions for Texas and Washington? And why, at least for the past few decades, has Montana attracted primarily writers? In the 21st century, at least 9 influential art colonies exist in the West, predictably in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, and Austin, but also in smaller places such as Carmel, Santa Fe and Taos, and Missoula and Livingston. But why the clearly defined differentiation? Photographers in Carmel, musicians in Texas and the coastal cities, painters in New Mexico, writers in Montana. 3/4 of a century ago, well before Joseph Kinsey Howard launched Northern Rockies environmental literature with Montana High, Wide, and Handsome, before A.B. Guthrie won the Pulitzer Prize for The Big Sky and Richard Hugo's poetry and classics such as The Lady in Kicking Horse Reservoir set the Montana literary tradition in motion, the majority of cultural observers would have predicted that if the Northern Rockies were to produce any cultural attainment worthy of attention, it would be a place of visual artists, not wordsmiths. With the 3 grand alpine national parks of Yellowstone, Glacier, and Grand Tetons already extant or in the process of becoming, the Northern Rockies did not lack for aesthetic possibilities. And the region had a range of place-based cultures, from the Blackfeet and the Crows to stoic cowboys and dust-blown homesteaders that early 20th century artists and painters and filmmakers seemed to favor. Finally, Montana in particular had Charlie Russell. And only one other place in America, New Mexico, with Georgia O'Keeffe, has an artist stood as so emblematic of a state as Charlie Russell did and does for Montana. Yet unlike in the high desert, southern Rockies country of New Mexico, in the northern Rockies it was not the visual artists, but the writers whose voices prevail. This is a book, then, that in part attempts to throw light on why that unexpected development happened the way it did. But beyond that explanation, this book is an effort to resurrect a regional visual legacy. Not that this legacy is exactly invisible. Recent works such as Peter Hasrick's Drawn to Yellowstone, Artists in America's First National Park, in 2002, and Larry Peterson's Call of the Mountains, The Artist of Glacier National Park, in 2001, address parts of it. But it's a visual legacy we tend to see today as through a dusty window, seriously in need of cleaning.
So that's a really large question you've posed, but let's just try to scale down for a minute and start small. Let's look at the rock images that are our first art, and tell us about those rock images and how they fit into your question of why we have writers here.
Well, the rock images are our oldest visual imagery of this part of the world. Some of them, archaeologists believe, date back 8,000 years. And there are others that are only 200 or 300 years ago, some of them obviously done during the historic period since they represent things like guns and horses. So that's a very, very deeply embedded visual tradition in this part of the world, as it is really across all of the American West. There's not a great deal of rock art east of the Mississippi River, but there's a lot of it in the West. But I think the reason I wanted to begin with that is because one of the questions that I confronted in this book was a comparison of Northern Rockies art with the art of some of the other regions around the West. And the one that struck me as probably providing the most intriguing comparison was the Southwest, particularly New Mexico, because those visual traditions began at about the same time. A lot of the same painters and photographers were involved in both. And today, a place like Santa Fe, for example, sells more art than any other city in the United States except for New York and Los Angeles. I mean, Santa Fe is a town the size of Missoula. So clearly the visual art tradition in that part of the world not only survived into the present, but has become an internationally recognized tradition. Whereas in our part of the world, in the Northern Rockies, while we had this very rich visual tradition up until about the middle of the 20th century, it's really kind of faded away and has been replaced, I think, by a sense of Montana as a colony for writers and by the very vibrant literary tradition that we have. And so in attempting to explain that, one of the things that I tried to do in the book was to grapple with how these ancient images of the West as either a place that's been long inhabited by Native people or one that is quite recently settled came to characterize these two regions and their art. And in the Southwest, there has long been a tradition of portraying Indians in that part of the world, and indeed through art that looks at the country itself there as an ancient homeland for Native people. I mean, you just can't avoid the fact that Native people have been there for thousands of years. Whereas I think in our part of the world, we sort of forgot that. Back at the beginning of the 20th century, we were concerned that Indians in the Northern Rockies and Northern Plains were losing their cultures, losing their traditions. We represented them as basically as people who were vanishing, the vanishing red man. And so I very deliberately started the book out with a chapter on these rock images because I wanted to make a point that this sense that the Northern Rockies is a recently settled country is a mistake, that this is actually, just as the Southwest is, an anciently inhabited country.
Well, one of the questions you ask in this book is why, I'm quoting you, why do we place such great value on the vertical, on the drama of the mountains? And your answer, in part, has to do with one painter, Albert Bierstadt.
Albert Bierstadt, yes.
Tell us about him.
Yeah, he's a fascinating figure in the art history of the West. He's a German-American who was trained in Germany. It's difficult to say whether he actually attended the Dusseldorf Academy or he just went and sort of hung out there with the other people who were learning the Romantic Age art traditions in Germany. But he brought, in any case, a kind of a German Romantic sensibility to the art of the West. And he's one of the very first of the American landscape artists who actually gets to the Northern Rockies. He got to the Wind River Range with the Lander Expedition, which was charting an immigrant road in 1859, and began his first portrayals of the Rockies with some really dramatic paintings of the winds in the early 1860s. And he's the sort of figure who basically sort of channels the whole Romantic age's sensibility about nature and God being synonyms. I mean, when he looks at a mountain, one of the peaks in the winds, for example, to Bierstadt's eye, he's basically seeing God in kind of a completely unrefined, unfiltered way. He's looking directly into the mind of the deity. And this was very much a kind of a Romantic Age idea that Henry David Thoreau had a great line, "Is not nature rightly read that for which we commonly take her to be the symbol merely?" In other words, is not nature really, really God? And Bierstadt painted that. And he painted it in a kind of a Old Testament drama, so that he, as I argue in the chapter on him in the book, he really kind of wants the Rockies not to be 11 and 12 and 13,000 foot peaks, but he wants them to be 20,000 foot peaks. And so one of the criticisms of him in his day was that he was portraying an impossibly vertical landscape in the American West. I call my chapter Albert Bierstadt and the Mountains of Mars, because really the only place in the solar system where we have mountains as big as Bierstadt wanted the Rockies to be are on the planet Mars. But he really gives us, I think, this potent sense of nature as sacred, and that's probably why he ended up being rediscovered. He was sort of forgotten for about 75 years, and then he was rediscovered in the 1960s with the beginning of the environmental movement and the age of ecology, which also embraced the idea of nature as sacred. And Bierstadt's paintings probably are the best version, I think, of that anyone did. He did a famous painting of Yellowstone Falls, and as I say in that particular chapter, I've been to the spot where he painted that, and he clearly just about doubled the height of the falls. But he also did things like, for example, when he was in the winds, he probably was painting East Temple Peak. That's what the primary mountain in most of his very dramatic Wind River landscapes looks like, except that he adds all kinds of elements to the scene. He puts a camp of Shoshone Indians, which he had seen out on the sagebrush plains 20 miles away, up at 10,000 feet right below the peak. And then he adds a waterfall, which he probably saw in Yosemite, but he puts it in the scene because, as Bierstadt always said when people ask him about the authenticity of his work, he said, "I'm not trying to represent an actual spot. I'm trying to represent the feeling that a place invokes."
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with historian Dan Flores. Right after a short break, we'll hear about mountain men and cowboys. Stay tuned. One of the things I really like about this book is that you're debunking a lot of myths and you're bringing in facts that allow us, through these paintings and these photographs, to look at the West in a different way. You describe the mountain men as employees of the fur trade, the first extractive industry.
Right. I think that's that sort of new vision about who the men of the fur trade were, and the women of the fur trade too, which is kind of another new discovery in Western history. We ignored women in all sorts of endeavors in Western history. And one of the places we did was in the fur trade, and thankfully we've gotten some really great work here recently about the role of women in the fur trade. But we've always had this notion, I think, of the Jim Bridger, Joe Meek, classic sort of white Anglo-Saxon young man who goes west in the wake of Lewis and Clark, who sort of is a rugged individualist on his own hook, and who dominates the trade there. He's sort of, basically, he's Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone in a Western form. And as a lot of people have been fond of saying over the years, the mountain men managed to out-Indian the Indians, which, of course, is quite a trick when you start thinking about it, and also was very unlikely as well. But what we've discovered and what I tried to show in the chapter on Alfred Jacob Miller's paintings, because he's the most famous skilled painter who goes west and portrays the mountain man, is that the truth is, like many of the people in these early extractive industries, these guys were hired hands. They were sort of working stiffs, and large numbers of them, a very large percentage of the mountain men, were actually ethnic. They were either blends as a result of liaisons between Europeans and Indian women, of Orkney Scots who married into Indian families, or French Canadians who married into Indian families, and even the white Virginians and Kentuckians who went west often did the same thing. If they didn't marry into Indian families, because this was one of the ways for instance, to advance the trade itself, they, when they were in the Southwest, they married into Hispanic families in New Mexico. So what we're emerging with here in probably the last 20 years or so is a much more complex and, to me, far more interesting idea of who these fur trade people were. And I try to argue in that chapter that what Alfred Jacob Miller was portraying for us, in effect, was the future of America. These ethnic blends between various European groups, one with the other and with the native people. And so it portrays a different sort of West in the early 19th century than we've thought existed. And Miller painted it beautifully.
Some of the things that come out in your essays are that these artists, these painters, these people who came West came with preconceived notions, and then they tried to create what they thought was here, like Remington. Frederick Remington came with a notion of cowboys, and he created a lot of art that perpetuated a myth that we're still trying to get rid of today.
Well, there's no question that particularly in the period from about 1880 to into the 1920s, the major theme in the portrayal of the West is a nostalgia for what was. Historians call this frontier anxiety. It's the sort of art that not only Frederick Remington, but Charlie Russell really excelled in. Charlie Russell called his version of this Dreamtime Montana. It basically was Montana at the moment when Charlie Russell first saw it. And he spent the rest of his career into the middle 1920s portraying that time. So what these artists end up doing, I mean, there are a couple of exceptions. They happen to be the artists who I admire the most. Maynard Dixon is one of the exceptions. But for the most part, people like Frederick Remington and Charlie Russell are portraying a world that no longer existed and ignoring the world that was around them. As the West, as Montana, Wyoming, Alberta, Idaho were changing and evolving into a 20th century form, these artists, for the most part, paid no attention whatsoever. And in a lot of cases, it was left to photographers, particularly to a photographer like Evelyn Cameron, who uses her camera to record what is actually happening in the early 20th century, because many of the male artists, photographers and painters both, that's not what interests them. They're fascinated with really what is kind of this male escapist fantasy of the Old West as it existed in the 1870s and early 1880s. And after that, I mean, L.A. Huffman, very famous Montana photographer whose work I do a chapter on in the book, stopped photographing after 1905.
Because of the fences.
Right? Yeah, because of the fences and the changes homesteaders were settling. He was working in eastern Montana, and it was the time of the big breakout in eastern Montana. And he stopped photographing after 1905 and just printed up the photographs that he had shot back in the 1880s and 1890s. I mean, and it, the result of that is that it sort of fixates us on the frontier period, this brief point in time that many places only lasts for 3 or 4 years, to the exclusion of the very fascinating history that follows it all up. And so I'm not the first to lament this about the way the artist portrayed the West, but this nostalgic view looking back on the 1870s as if it was this magical time, I think has, in a lot of ways, kind of distorted the history of the West, and particularly this part of the West, because, I mean, let's face it, most of us learn our history today through movies. In the early 20th century, a lot of people learn their history through visual imagery, reproductions of art or newspaper illustrations, and this is kind of the shorthand for the history that we learn, and it got skewed by that kind of focus.
If you put 10 people out on the street and they all watch a car accident, the famous result is that you will get 10 different versions of that. And Indeed. So we have a whole parade of artists coming out to the West and sending back east and to the rest of the world their impressions. So your job is to sort through all of that information and try to give us what really happened.
Yeah, my job, I think, at least this was the task I set for myself in this project, was to try to figure out how these paintings and these photographs sort of set up the country, the United States, to a certain extent the world, and our region itself, to memorialize our history. And it's been said that a place doesn't exist until a writer, a photographer, or a painter portrays it and presents a version of it to the rest of the culture. And I think if you take that as kind of an operative premise in this instance, then what these particularly late 19th and early 20th century visual artists did for us is to give us a sense of the Northern Rockies as distinct from any other part of the West, where a kind of Edenic wilderness prevailed. I mean, and we, of course, still think of this part of the world as this wilderness Eden as compared to anywhere else in the West. I describe a scene in the introduction of this book where when I first moved to Montana in 1992, I did a float trip down the Missouri River. A couple of friends and I camped out in the White Cliffs section. And I was awakened the next morning by the sun hitting those white cliffs in this blinding theatrical almost painterly kind of way, jerked me out of my sleeping bag, took me immediately to the edge of the river, and I looked out across that landscape, and there were mule deer pogoing across through the hills, and there were waterfowl arrowing down the stream, and all of it under this impossibly lit sky and these white cliffs. And I had this extraordinary sense of deja vu from that. But, and I write about this in the book, I'd never been to this spot in my life. And I realized only later that what was happening was that I had sort of been preloaded in advance by looking at art books and Western art, much of it about the Northern Rockies, without even thinking about that all that much, so that when I actually was in the spot on the Missouri River and saw this scene, it struck me as something that I immediately recognized. And I know that I'm not alone in that. I know that other people have that same experience. We've all seen this art so much that it's pre-adapted us to know what to think about this part of the world.
One of the graphic examples of that is Custer and the Battle of the Little Bighorn. The interpretation given to us was that Custer made this heroic last stand.
Yeah.
We'll continue this conversation next week, when we'll also talk about why two women artists had opposite experiences in the West and how Eastern critics reacted to the photography of Ansel Adams. Dan Flores divides his time between the Bitterroot Valley of western Montana and the Galisteo River Valley outside Santa Fe, New Mexico. You can find more information about him and his books at therightquestion.blogspot.com.
The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, enriching intellectual, cultural, and civic life for all Montanans, and by Montana's Cultural Trust. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio. Sheree Newman, producer, Michael Marsalek, executive producer, Beth Ann Osteen, studio engineer. Special thanks to Lisa Simon, David Moore, Barbara Thoreau, and Kim Anderson. The music in this program was performed by Aaron Minnick, John Floridis, Lawrence Duncan, and Michael Marsalek. Look for more information about regional authors, send comments, and listen to this program again at therightquestion.blogspot.com. We're also on Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm Will Tilton, inviting you to tune in again next time for The Right Question.